I am crazy, just like you. I am crazy, just like you.
You're listening to Beautiful Minds Radio at CFRO 102.7 FM, Destigmatizing Mental Illness. I'm Richard J. Dalton, Jr. Tonight, we'll focus on eating disorders. Dr. Bertrand Wickless, a psychiatrist with the Provincial Specialized Eating Disorder Program at BC Children's Hospital in Vancouver, will be here in the studio. And for the personal story, I'll speak with Cindy Doby and her daughter, Jamie DeValder. Jamie had an eating disorder. The mental health condition of the week is body image distortion, also known as body dysmorphic disorder. But first, we're just going to have a chat with Dana Gillis, who's on, who handles social media for Beautiful Minds Radio and for businesses on a freelance basis. We're just going to chat a little bit about social media and eating disorders. So Dana, have websites banned pro-anorexia postings?
Well, there's been a move to do so on the part of Tumblr and Pinterest.
Notably, a couple of months ago, they made the decision to be self-censoring, to be self-monitoring on these issues because so many images and so many messages were coming up that were affecting friends and family of people who had eating disorders. They were the loudest voice against it.
And so there are three camps with different viewpoints on pro-anorexia sites. So can you just give me a brief summary of each and then we'll go into some detail?
Sure. Well, the three most vocal groups, first of all, there are those who say no censorship, any kind of censorship leads to more censorship. The second group is the group of family and friends who say that these images and this messaging is very negative and it's impacting individuals who are most vulnerable. And then there's the third group who stand back and say, hey, well, you know what, if it wasn't for social media, if it wasn't for the web, we wouldn't even be having this conversation right now. So it's good.
So can you tell me more about the group that says any self-censorship is bad?
Well, coming out of it gets to be further and further in our past now as we move on. But we look back at times like during war, the Second World War, and then the McCarthy era, where government came in and decided it had to censor for reasons of national security, and that just seeped into everybody's private lives, into their personal lives, and we came out of those experiences saying no censorship is the best censorship.
And so what about those who want the postings banned?
Well, their friends and family who see these images of their loved ones on the net and know that those people are very, very vulnerable. And so they are affected by this in a different way than any of us can ever imagine.
And then finally, there are those who are grateful for what the internet has done in this regard in terms of in a positive way. Tell me about that.
Well, absolutely. And of course, when we're talking about this group, we're talking about people who are seeing this from a distance and perhaps have time and inclination to come up with an academic opinion and are not being motivated by an emotional response to what's going on.
Thank you very much, Dana, for
You're
giving
welcome.
This overview of social media and eating disorders. You're listening to Beautiful Minds Radio, Destigmatizing Mental Illness. Follow us on Twitter at BeautifulMindsR. I'm just going to talk a little bit, but next you're going to hear Rain on Me by Chihuahua. But first I want to tell you about our website, www.beautifulmindsradio.org. Check the new posting of news and community events on Beautiful Minds Radio. Up next, we're going to have the mental health condition of the week, body image distortion. And up next is Rain on Me by Chihuahua.
up next, we'll have psychiatrist Dr. Chris Gorman and Brendan Beiser talking about the condition of the week, body image distortion.
There's nothing wrong with loving who you are, she said, because he made you perfect, babe. So hold your head up, girl, and you'll go far.
Thank you very much, Richard. Brendan, we got a big condition of the day. I know Richard likes to call it condition of the week, but you and I can only handle one day at a time. Listen, it's called body dysmorphic or image disorder, and it's a preoccupation with an imagined or barely noticeable defect in your personal appearance. As a result of this perceived flaw, people with body dysmorphic disorder are convinced that they are extremely ugly. The disorder can lead to depression, social anxiety, eating disorders, substance abuse, and even suicide. Patients can engage in compulsive activities such as mirror gazing and reassurance seeking that takes valuable time away from their family, their friends, and their work. And the psychological factors such as low self-esteem coupled with society's restrictive definition of beauty both contribute to it. Many researchers, however, now believe that body dysmorphic disorder also stems from a visual system problem. Speak, Brendan.
Well, thank you. Or maybe Brendan? I should bark. If I was a dog, I'd bark. You say speak, and that's what a dog does, correct?
Brendan.
But that's not what we're talking about, right?
No.
So, back to the topic at hand, doctor.
Yeah.
Body dysmorphic disorder.
Yeah,
try saying that 10 times fast.
Exactly. You know, you mentioned Michael Jackson and Joan Rivers.
Well, first of all, I want to clarify, when I say Michael Jackson, there's three Michael Jacksons that I know. There's the one I went to high school with, who that guy still owes me $20. And we're not talking about him. There's the Michael Jackson that used to play football for the Seattle Seahawks.
Okay.
Not talking about him.
All right.
But we are talking about Michael Jackson, the late Michael Jackson, the pop star. Right?
That is exactly who we're talking. The guy who had vitiligo and had his hair burned during a Pepsi commercial.
That's right. And a number of plastic surgeries, although it's never been confirmed, just rumored, though. But if you look at early pictures of Michael and later pictures of his life, you can see a difference, certainly in his nose and his cheekbone formation. And it suggested that he actually suffered from this condition. Joan Rivers is another name that springs to mind when you think about all the work that she's had done. And I know you've taken a particular interest in this Luca Rocco character.
Well, you know, Luca Rocco is a very, I mean, he's really been in the news, you know, all over the world for his exploits, I guess. But apparently, he had a couple of hair transplants and had some nodules. He thought he had some nodules on his face. So it sounds like he had this condition. But I can assure you the big problem with this condition is suicide and not homicide and cutting people up into little pieces and then mailing them to other people, which I think that's a syndrome that has not been described yet.
Not yet. It's interesting. You know, you bring up some interesting statistics. You mentioned that some people consider suicide. In 2010, it was suggested that 50% of the victims of this disorder attempted suicide. 75% of this people with this condition seeked out plastic surgery. And in 2010, it was published in a paper in the United States that it suggests that 9 million people actually suffered from this condition.
Brendan, you know what I'm beginning to think about you is you're a bit of a know-it-all. You know, you got all these stats, and you sort of lord over me with what you know. You know what I mean?
Well, I do. When you said you know what I think about you, I thought you were going to say something completely else. So I'm glad it was this.
Okay. Well, listen, the big thing is that, you know, this is a classical example of why we have Beautiful Minds Radio. This is a serious condition. The patients aren't even sure they have it. They're going to plastic surgeons to get help.
Yeah.
And hopefully, you know, if people listen to Mental Health Radio, and of course the best show in the world currently is now Beautiful Minds Radio, If they listen to that, they'll learn about the conditions. They'll know that there's nothing wrong with going and getting help. And the people I've treated with this condition, they do well. You know, you give them, you know, often a medication like Prozac can help in terms of the obsession. And then the therapy, we work on their self-esteem and help them see things differently.
You know, I was watching a video, actually, that video we can talk about off air, but relevant to this topic, I was watching a different video and on YouTube just about this very condition, and there was one of the women featured on this video. There were four people featured. She was 22 years old. She was an aspiring model, A-grade student, and all of a sudden, one day, she said she discovered these markings on her face that were, you know, not noticeable to anyone but herself. And it turned out that she became obsessed with what they were. And they really, like, when she was pointing them out to the journalist that was reporting on the story, you really couldn't notice them at all. But she saw them as, you know, the size of, you know, Mars on her face.
Well, and that's exactly what the problem. Thanks for bringing that up, Brendan. We're going to have to sign off here and turn back to my great friend Richard Dalton Jr. And thanks for participating in Condition of the Day.
That's Richard J. Dalton Jr.
Jay Dalton, I meant. You know what I meant.
And you're listening to Beautiful Minds Radio on Co-op Radio 102.7 FM. And that was Dr. Chris Gorman and actor Brendan Beiser. And now we're going to have a music break.
Strong enough to weather the rain.
In the studio, we have Dr. Bertrand Wickliss to discuss eating disorders and social media. Dr. Wickliss is a psychiatrist with the Provincial Specialized Eating Disorder Program at BC Children's Hospital. He has been treating children and adolescents with eating disorders since 2005 and has worked as a psychiatrist on eating disorder services in Canada, New Zealand, and the United States. He is also a clinical instructor at UBC's Department of Psychiatry. Dr. Wickliss, welcome to Beautiful Minds Radio.
Thank you for having me, Richard.
So many of these pro-ANA sites claim to provide an environment of acceptance for people living with the eating disorder lifestyle. Is it possible for someone to have a mental illness and without a mental illness to choose an eating disorder as their, quote, lifestyle?
Well, I would disagree with that, Richard. I think that the way most people who are in the field would view an eating disorder, it's not a choice. So it's not something a person chooses to have. It's not a lifestyle. It's a mental illness. So we frequently, when we explain this to parents, we say that this is not your fault. Your daughter or your son did not choose this. We don't know the cause of eating disorders, but it is a brain-based illness, just as diabetes or asthma is also a biological illness. So again, this is not something that people just simply choose to have. It's an illness that happens to them. But I think what can be confusing to parents and to young people or anybody with an eating disorder, because initially a person may go on a diet and that diet may go out of control and turn into an eating disorder. And so frequently what that person may feel is, it is my choice because I started by going on a diet. But it really isn't a choice because the diet got out of control and became an illness where it was no longer in their control. So it's a complicated issue. Similarly with recovery, there is some choice involved in recovery. To sit down and have a meal and to complete the meal, you have to make a choice to do so. So there isn't, it's not that there's no choice involved at all, but it's complicated. But having an eating disorder is not a choice.
I see. And do you believe that pro-ANA content should be taken off the web?
Well, I do, in the sense that I think that pro-ANA web pages are incredibly destructive, and I don't see any good coming out of them, and they're not good for people struggling with eating disorders. But again, I guess the issue about whether they should be taken off the web or not, that's gets into sort of issues of censorship and free speech, and I think that's an issue for politicians and for the public to decide. But from a medical perspective, I don't see any good that comes out of pro-ANA sites.
Many of these sites feature pictures of models and thin celebrities as thinspiration. What is your view on photoshopping? Should magazines and ads stop photoshopping models?
I don't know if I really have an opinion about whether they should stop that or not. I think these type of images probably are not healthy for people to see because, A, they're not realistic. It's not what real people look like. And so it does create these false ideals that young, vulnerable people can feel like they need to try to live up to. And if they, you know, inevitably we all fall short of these ideals. And so I think these setting up these false ideals are not healthy for our society. But whether, you know, again, it becomes sort of a public policy issue about, you know, requiring companies or media to not do this, that's something for politicians to decide. But again, I guess the point I want to make again is that I don't want to say that these type of images cause eating disorders because we don't know what the cause of eating disorders are. We know that eating disorders is a complex interplay between genetics and between various environmental stressors. These type of media images may contribute to the development of an eating disorder for somebody, but it's never just one cause. It's always multi-determined, and there's multiple factors that lead to somebody having an eating disorder. So it's never quite so simple as just saying these images cause eating disorders. It's much more complex than that.
I see. And many of these websites, they have tips and tricks on how to fool your doctor, right? And have you experienced any patients who have tried to trick you?
Sure. We experience this quite often. It's quite common for a person's eating disorder to try to trick the doctor in various ways so that the doctor thinks that the young person or the person struggling with the eating disorder is getting better when they're not actually not. The way I like to think of it, it's not that the patient is trying to trick me, but it's actually the eating disorder is trying to trick me. And if you notice, the language I'm using is that we will externalize the eating disorder as something almost separate from the person. It's a part of them, but it's not the whole of them, because eating disorders are incredibly tricky illnesses. And we do this so as not to pathologize the person. We don't want the person to feel like they're a bad person for, you know, doing certain things that might trick the doctor. The way we like to think about it is the eating disorder is incredibly tricky, and the eating disorder wants to trick the doctor so as to continue its hold on the person with the eating disorder.
Interesting. Now, these proanocytes, they do they really do not promote recovery, but there is some sense of community. Is that beneficial in any way for those people who have eating disorders?
I don't think so. I think, you know, one would think, sure, community is a good thing and bringing people together is a good thing. But for proanocytes, what's bringing them together is an illness, and it's an illness that is incredibly destructive. It has the highest mortality rate of all psychiatric illnesses. It's an illness that destroys lives. It separates young people from their families, from their friends, from their interests. Anorexia nervosa is a horrible illness that devastates people's lives and families. And for that to be the basis of bringing people together, that I don't think that that helps anything that promotes the illness and perpetuates the illness, I don't think is a good thing. I would want people to come together based upon values of you know, living their life to the fullest of their potential, living their true values of what they want to do with their life in terms of, you know, friends, family, faith, job, and so forth. Those are the things that we want to help young people with these eating disorders to focus on and to develop those aspects of their lives, as opposed to developing just the eating disorder as the most important thing.
So you mentioned the highest rate of death for this mental illness.
Correct.
So what is the physiological cause of death for someone who has an eating disorder?
Right. So I think last time I looked is about 50 to 75% of the time that when people die, it's due to medical complications. So the most common medical complication would be some type of cardiac event, an arrhythmia or heart failure, something, or heart attack, something like that. The other most common cause of death is suicide.
Interesting. But that's an amazing statistic, the highest cause of death for any...
Psychiatric
illness.
So higher than schizophrenia, higher than bipolar disorder.
Interesting. Okay, well, we're going to take a break for just a short break, and we'll be back shortly talking to Dr. Wickliss about eating disorders. You're listening to Beautiful Minds Radio on Co-op Radio 102.7 FM. I'm Richard J. Dalton, Jr., talking to Dr. Bertrand Wickliss about eating disorders and social media. So, Dr. Wickliss, how are patients evaluated to determine whether they are right for an eating disorder program?
Well, I can talk a little bit about how we do it at Children's Hospital. When somebody comes in for an assessment, first of all, they're referred to our program by a GP typically, and then they have a three-hour assessment. Part of the assessment is a medical exam by a pediatrician, and the other part of the assessment is a psychiatric exam, a psychiatric interview by the psychiatrist and the pediatrician together. And so what we're doing is, on the medical side, looking at their physical health, getting their weight, their height, vital signs, and blood work, important blood work, to see how healthy they are, and to see if they're having any medical complications related to being underweight or any other type of eating disorder symptoms. And then from a psychiatric standpoint, we're trying to understand, we get a history of their eating difficulties, we get a try to better understand their own thoughts and feelings about their weight, about their body image, and through this try to make a determination of whether they actually have an eating disorder or not.
And what are the DSM-4 criteria?
Right. So there's three DSM-4 diagnoses for eating disorders. There's anorexia nervosa, bulimia nervosa, and eating disorder not otherwise specified, which is sort of a catch-all. If somebody doesn't quite meet criteria for anorexia or bulimia, then they go in the eating disorder not otherwise specified. So in a nutshell, anorexia nervosa is when somebody is underweight, when they are unable to maintain a healthy weight because they're afraid of, they have an intense fear of gaining weight, and they have a very negative body image where they feel really bad about their body and feel that they are overweight, even though other people would tell them that they're actually of healthy weight. So that's sort of, without getting too detailed about the criteria, that's sort of the general gist of it. With bulimia nervosa, it's a little bit different. To have bulimia, one needs to engage in binging behaviors, where one is overeating and out of control with their eating, and then engaging in some form of compensation. So the most common form would be through vomiting, but there's other ways of compensating for overeating. And the psychological piece with bulimia is having an overvaluation of weight and shape, where a person feels that their weight and shape is much more important or overvalued compared to all other aspects of their life or their sense of self. So those would be the descriptions of the two major eating disorders.
And what is binge eating?
Well, the definition of binge eating is to eat an objectively large amount of food that would be sort of be above and beyond what someone would typically eat, and also having a sense of being out of control, where you're eating a large amount of food in a short period of time and you can't stop yourself. So, you know, when I'm assessing whether someone might be engaging in binge eating, I'll ask them, you know, do you ever feel like you're overeating? And so, for example, if, you know, instead of having maybe two pieces of toast with peanut butter or jam, you're having a whole loaf of bread at one time. That would be an example of a binge.
Amazing. So what about a whole bag of potato chips? And I'm asking this for personal reasons.
Well, you know, a whole bag of potato chips, whether that's a binge or not, I guess it depends on when you're eating the potato chips. Do you feel out of control? Are you not able to stop yourself? And, you know, how big is the bag of potato chips?
Right.
If it's just a small bag, then it certainly wouldn't be a binge. If it was a huge bag, then I would probably, you know, start asking you more questions about, like, well, how did you feel about it? If afterwards you felt really guilty and ashamed and you felt horrible about yourself and your body and you felt like you needed to do something about it, then I would start worrying about that being a binge. If this is something that's happening on a regular basis, then that would also make me worried if it's a binge. But if on one occasion you just happen to eat a whole bag of potato chips and kind of feel, you know, yucky afterwards, I wouldn't be too concerned.
Vancouver's pretty ethnically diverse. Do you see a cross-section of the community here with eating disorders?
We do. We do. We certainly see our fair share of different ethnic minorities. And, you know, eating disorders is it occurs in all, you know, cultures in North America. So there's no ethnic group that's going to be immune from eating disorders.
And is this psychiatric care, medical care, or a combination?
It's a combination. So it's definitely, you know, good care for an eating disorder is always multidisciplinary. It includes psychiatrists, internists, pediatrician, nurses, counselors, dietitians, occupational therapists. So it's truly a multidisciplinary approach in terms of treatment.
And what centers can people go to where that would be covered by provincial health insurance?
Right. Well, I think we're lucky in BC. There are a lot of different centers for eating disorder treatment that are public. There is Children's Hospital, where I work, which works with children and adolescents. There is the Woodstone Residential Treatment Center, Galeano Island, which is a relatively new residential program and a fantastic program that's available young people ages 17 to 24. And that is a public facility where, you know, it's paid for by MSP. And now they're actually just opening private beds as well, where people can also pay privately. And then St. Paul's also has a program. It's an tertiary care program for adults with eating disorders. And then throughout the community, there's a range of community mental health teams that also treat eating disorders.
Great. Well, Dr. Wickliss, thanks for coming on Beautiful Minds Radio.
Great. Thank you. My pleasure.